Yeah, I'm not going to stream because I don't want to show my face.
All right, so...
At least not until I get my French citizenship.
Yeah, you're not a citizen. You're not part of the citizens' movement. Are you a
subordinate
member?
I'm a citizen according
member?
To the statutes of the Constitution of the Year One.
Is that an unbad thing?
No, it's from this French Revolution. It was the Constitution that was devised but never actually put in place because they were in a constant state of war. And the Constitution of the Year One, you basically, the conditions for citizenship are either you're born in this country or if you're a foreigner, you lived here for at least 1 year, you either work for a living or you support an orphan or you marry a French person or you take care of an old person or the National Assembly considers that you are worthy of humanity.
And UNBAD's going to bring that constitution back?
We're going to make a new constitution.
Year two.
But the constitution of the year one is a historic left. Like all through the 19th century, people would say, like, what are our demands? We want bread and the constitution of the year one. Because the constitution of the year one is actually more radical than pretty much any Western quote-unquote democratic institute. For example, representatives, the deputies, would be recallable delegates. And they would serve for very short terms. And there'd be much more control over government officials by the population than exists in like American or French or whatever constitutions today. And that reflects a debate between the Girondins and the Jacobins.
Is this like year 234 now or something like that? Are there still people in France who go by the revolutionary calendar?
I sometimes throw it in, like if I've been doing like a Google Doc with people, I'll throw like the date in the revolutionary time, but most people have no idea what year or time it is, except for certain quotations or like certain laws that were passed when this calendar was in effect. We still talk about like the year of, you know, Floréal, like year two Floréal, blah, 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 for certain historical events.
Uh-huh. Pertaining to the revolution.
Yeah, like when it was in effect.
New calendar is so based. I mean, when is Trump going to throw in something like that?
It was in force for 12 years, from 1793 to 1805, and for 18 days during the Paris Commune.
Oh, they brought it back during the Commune. That's what I'm talking about.
But people, like, I think this is kind of forgotten. Did you see that piece with New International about Citizen Marx, or did you listen to the Forms episode about it?
No, I did pick up Citizen Marx, but I haven't read much. I haven't looked into it much yet. But yeah, I think that we'll definitely have an episode about that soon. Because
that'll be good.
Sean is into
people gonna forget this link.
Yeah,
you know,
the Republican aspect. I should say off the top, first of all, we're back with Henry J. Wallace, our French correspondent. He's going to be talking about his new journal, New International. Me and Varn contributed to, and I also want to say up top that Sean is still recovering from his tonsillectomy. Without going into too much detail, he is certainly not able to record right now and might not be able to for a couple weeks. So until then, you're stuck with me. But
we love you, Andy, and we love Sean, and we, you know, hope he has a speedy recovery.
Fandies rejoice. Sean heads, hope you'll come back another time. But we do, like I said, we've got one of the most popular guests of 2024 back again, Henry J. Wallace.
Here we are.
How you feel? You got a little bit of a cold, so sorry about the sniffles, everybody. But you got sick at a super spreader event of communism.
Yeah, I was hanging out with some people and I got sick, but I'm happy to be here as always and talk to you, Andy. Please don't put any horrible folk punk music in the intro or outro.
Did I do that last time?
No.
Do you think I'm always putting folk punk in
I just wanted to be clear about the limits of our friendship. It ends at folk punk.
Well, I know you don't want me to dox you, but you've got a bit of a folk punk background.
I'm more of a folk background than a folk punk background. But so you wanted to talk about the French situation. Do you want me just to explain what happened since I came on last?
Yeah, let's start with that. I'm a little bit hesitant to do that because we said we'd start with that one time, and that ended up being a 2-hour episode. And we
no,
didn't
I'll
get
be
to
quick.
Anything else.
Okay. I'll be very fast.
All right, I'll start
so
the clock.
So basically, okay.
Year zero.
Clock has started.
Let's go.
So since the last episode, Macron was not able to sort of form a really strong government. There's a kind of very weak government in place that is tottering on collapse. Folks in the know have told me it'll either collapse in December, January, or February. So the government will probably fall apart. And part of the reason is that there's a budgetary crisis where Macron has basically given so many handouts to the rich that there's a huge budget deficit. And, you know, Brussels demands that we have a better budgetary situation. But Macron doesn't actually have the forces necessary to ram through an austerity program and like fleece social services. So it's not clear exactly how the budget will be passed. People on the left are continuing to propose legislation, like the France Unbowed are pushing, you know, removing the retirement reform, removing the sort of really harsh censorship law about quote unquote apology for terrorism. There's a lot of different proposals that are still moving forward from the left, but it's a situation where nobody quite has the strength necessary to push their program.
What is the government now?
It's a sort of, it's a confabulation of the center and the right with the sort of benediction of the far right, although the far right is not technically in power.
But that's not a majority, right?
It's enough to kind of hold things together, you know, on a hamstring.
But is it even a plurality of this coalition?
I mean, I have to look at the numbers, but it's enough that they're basically able to. It's weird because, like, they don't have to get away from all of the details because we don't want to go for 2 hours. To put it very simply, they have enough power to superficially maintain control, but not enough to really do what they want to do. So it's going to be hard for them to pass anything or get anything done, really.
And what we're looking at
is basically the collapse of this center and right coalition that's going to lead, like, to kind of the point of everything I'm saying is there's going to be a conflict in the coming year. We're having municipal elections in like 2026. We're probably going to have new assembly elections in 2025 in the summer. And it's possible that if this government collapses, Macron would be sort of forced to resign. If he resigned, though, he could maybe try to like run again. Because if he resigned, there'd be like new elections in like 20 to 50 days. Mm-hmm. And he could theoretically run himself again. Right. And so we could have a presidential election, a national assembly election, and then after municipal elections, all within the span of like a few years. So there's a lot that's in play right now. And what most of the people that, you know, who I am speaking with and I esteem to have a clue are saying is that it's going to come down to the left versus the far right.
You know,
that the center is kind of worn out. It's done.
When you describe it, I wonder if it's even something of a blessing that Macron put in this very weak centrist government, because we've been thinking a lot about the so-called anti-incumbency bias in the U.S. after the elections. And in the U.K., you saw Labour come back to power with a very dominant election showing, and they're already incredibly unpopular. So if elections were held today in the U.K., the Conservatives would just come right back to power. Even though nothing has changed in terms of Labour's policy or Conservative policy, there's just so much anger towards government, like the governors, the political class.
It's not that we're not in a bad position overall, like the Unbowed. And to give, I looked it up while you were talking. The current government of Barnier has 212 out of 577 seats. So they're a minority government. And basically anything they want to do, they have to do with the blessing of the far right. It's also possible that the left could accomplish some of its goals with the help of the far right, which is a whole another topic we can talk about. Mm. But basically the idea is that there was a big debate this year because, you know, in parliaments, you have a sort of schedule of who gets to propose stuff when, right? And I think it was a month ago or early this month, it was the Le Pen's party had their time to propose a law. And they proposed to get rid of this retirement age reform that Macron forced through. And there was a big debate on the left of like, do we vote for their thing or do we not vote for it? Because we also want to do that, right? Ultimately, their project failed. And so it was kind of a moot debate. And the left has now proposed to abolish this retirement reform. And it's, you know, it's basically up to the far right. Like, if they want to lie to their voters and say, we actually don't really care about your retirement, then they won't vote for it.
What kind of leverage does Brussels have over all of this? Like, you're not in a Greece type situation where you need bailouts, right?
No, we're not in a Greece type situation, but we're still, you know, the European, it's actually very interesting. If you go back to 2005, there was a bunch of EU stuff that had to be written into sort of like French politics constitutionally regarding economic policy, et cetera. And there was a referendum about whether to do it or not. And the referendum failed. And it was done anyway. You know, so there's this whole thing about like, there's basically a fundamental conflict between democracy in the true sense and the European Union and its sort of ideological construction of liberalism. Because it's basically, you know, I think it's comparable to the Soviet Union, maybe even more extreme in the way that liberalism is enshrined into the EU system.
Almost like European communists had something to do with building the whole structure.
When I compare it to the Soviet Union, I mean the Soviet, obviously the Soviet system has an economic, you know, ideology or program it's proposing, and Europe has an opposite one, right?
Well, but what I'm trying to say is that the Euro communists, so to speak, were a big part of the foundation of the EU, were they not?
Well, I mean, we can talk about Kojève if you want, but I always agree with him that Hegel was an atheist.
All right, that's over my head. Let's talk about
that's
New
gonna
International
make a lot of
really
people
fast.
Mad. You're going to get unsubscribers for that one.
Maybe Nikki the Hegelian will unsubscribe. Yeah, New International. What is this exactly? Is this the organ of France Unbowed, the English language organ?
No, it's an independent.
Is this
thing.
The scaffolding
I have my opinions.
A new communist international, the fifth international, or even sixth?
No, well, when I talk about a new international, first of all, this has nothing to do with Max Schachtman. So this is not a Schachtmanite organization. This has nothing to do with Pathfinder Press or any of Trotsky's stuff.
It has nothing to do with all the other journals that are called New International.
Or New Internationalist or anything like that, right? But New International is basically a attempt to have a popular organ that is open to contributions and brings people together from all over the world. So, for example, we had a piece on Palestine by my friend who is a Palestinian. It seems obviously rational that you would do that, right? And I want to continue to expand the sort of geographic and topical scope. So I have, there's actually a France Unbowed deputy who sent me an extract of one of his writings about the Anthropocene that I'm currently editing and I'm going to publish as an article probably next month. And the goal of the journal is to have something that's popular, that's, you know, easy for people to read, share, contribute to, and gives an alternative to a lot of what dominates left English language discourse, which I'm not happy with. So we're not going to run like a quarterly denunciation of Michel Foucault, right? We're going to talk about actual struggles and topics that are actually interesting to folks.
But will you run a quarterly defense of Michel Foucault?
I don't think we'll need to do that, but...
The site is newintermag.com. And just looking at the sort of editorial letter page, it's called Our Goal. We, the people of the earth, are handed an immense task. The liberation of all, or in other words, the care for the common good of all that live and breathe together. This is a short editorial statement. I encourage people to read it. It ends with the beautiful words, omnia sunt communia. Everything is communal. The banner of the most revolutionary wing of the peasant wars. And there's quotes from our favorite armchair man, Bordiga, in there. But then... less so up our listeners' alley, or at least just judging by the Discord discourse at the Antifada Discord, which if you'd like access to, you can subscribe on Patreon. You'll get a link to the Discord.
I intermittently intervene there.
Yep. And at Henry, and he will appear. There's, lots of, you know, people there like Left Communism and Bordiga, but they're not so hot on France Unbowed, too ultra for that. How do you square the circle there?
I have my opinions. I am working with the Unbowed. I think they're cool. You know, I think it's something that people should learn from. But my opinions do not determine everything that goes into the journal. Like Andy wrote a piece with Varn that I'm not 100% in agreement with, and we ran it because Andy and Varn are living in America and their opinion I respect, right? So you don't have to have some kind of strict ideological line. This isn't like, you know, I've always thought that Jacobin had a kind of weirdly narrow ideological line when it came to domestic stuff. And then they would like reach out and do, you know, they might like talk about stuff outside of that world when they did a historical or an international piece or whatever. But I want something that's more open than that.
Mm-hmm.
First thing. Second thing about my own ideology or my own politics. I quote Jean Jaurès in that piece, and some people might think, like, Jean Jaurès, that's a reformist. Well, Bordiga compared him to Christ, and Bordiga argued that in his time, everything that Jaurès did was, you know, coherent, and there was no, like, betrayal or treason, or that Jaurès didn't do anything wrong, per se, right? And when you see Jaurès talking about the people before him, he has a critique, like, Jaurès is not going to just take up the form of struggle of Blanqui. He has a radically different proposal to make. Jaurès believes, for people that aren't familiar with him, and I'm writing an article we'll publish about him hopefully next month, that a majority of the population is necessary for revolution in the modern era. It's no longer possible for a minority of people to affect a revolution. Mm. That's a Jaurès argument. And that is because Jaurès is living in the age of mass politics, of unions and the beginning of political parties and the beginning of a really, you know, and sort of a fully electrified social body, right?
Who was Jean Jaurès?
Jean Jaurès is a great French socialist leader from the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And he was assassinated on the eve of World War I because he was a staunch anti-war activist, mm-hmm. right?
So he might have been like a Luxembourg type figure in France had he survived.
Well, I mean, This article I'm referring to of Bordiga is called In the Red Light of Sacrifice, about Luxembourg and Liebknecht. And, you know, he says that he lumps Jaurès in with them. Jaurès and Luxembourg knew each other. They were active. You know, Jaurès spoke German perfectly and intervened in German politics occasionally. And sometimes Jaurès and Luxembourg were aligned. Sometimes they weren't aligned. But that's a whole nother. We'd have to do a whole show just about Jaurès to explore sure. all that.
Speculative the reason I'm bringing Jaurès it, fiction we'd have to do.
Yeah, but the point about talking about him is like somebody like Jaurès can, you know, in my view, carry on a tradition that starts in the French Revolution. Like Robespierre and Blanqui don't have the same politics. Blanqui and Jaurès don't have the same politics. Jaurès and Mélenchon don't have the same politics, right? But there's clearly a tradition there, a political tradition of the left that has certain core values that are the same, that even somebody like Bordiga or Trotsky or, you know, like, people recognize that these are folks living and struggling in their own time. And that's what I want the New International to foster, is to say, let's think through our time, right?
Yeah, so
we need ideas of the 21st century. We can't just stick. So like, if you see me promoting the Unbowed stuff, it's because they seem to me to have theory for the 21st century.
Yeah, that makes sense. And especially theory that you can see works where you live. In France,
yeah.
And has done very well in an election. And yeah. So Varn and I, we wrote an article called The Undying Appeal of Brunch right after the election. And I imagine your problem with it is probably that we're very critical of the bourgeois state and electoral politics and have a line in there that's just stop even thinking about orienting towards electoral politics, because it's going to inevitably suck us back in to a resistance to Trump that turns into the capital resistance. The uppercase are the kind of paralysis of waiting for the next election and hoping the Democrats will be a little bit better this time, which is sort of the history of the U.S. class struggle for the last 100 years or so. What I was sort of thinking, reading the piece by Francis Parny, Communism Lives in the France Unbowed, going through this article, which it's a very long piece by someone who is part of the Communist Party and has now been won over to Unbowed, is that in France, there's a left wing of capital and there's a right wing of capital. In the United States, there's a left wing of capital and a right wing of capital. But the left wing of capital has become so attached to the Democratic Party that it is just sort of stuck in the center. And as a result, for those of us who are leftists, anti-capitalist or otherwise, we have this impression that the left wing of capital hasn't been tried. They haven't really been given a shake, because Harris and Biden and Clinton have not run on the arguments of the left wing of capital. And we have the impression, this is the idea of Bernie would have won, that if social democracy became the platform of the Democratic Party, they would win and they'd be able to do these things. In Europe, this has happened, and for the most part, it's failed. So in terms of talking about electoral politics and parliamentarism in general, Europe's kind of at a more advanced place in one sense, because they've been through, people know what social democracy is, or like average voters know what social democracy is and what it looks like. And to them, it looks like Francois Hollande, right? So there had to be a progression from there, both in terms of what the left wing of capital looks like, and then what a challenge to the left wing of capital from the left looks like, which is represented by Mélenchon. And this article goes a lot into how Mélenchon has seen the failures of the Socialist Party and the Communist Party and came to some adjustments. Do you think that's a fair summary, or it's not a summary?
Yeah, it's like a fair summary. And I think, you know, if my sort of proposal internationally, it's not, hey, just do the Frandsen Bout in your own country. It's build a radical left. And the Frandsen Bout is an example of a radical left. The Frandsen Bout has a structure that we can talk about if you want, that is a movement structure, as you know, the movement form as opposed to the party form or the commune form per Kristen Ross. My critique of your piece would be the same that I would give of Kristen Ross's extract that was published concerning the Earth uprisings, the Soulèvement de la Terre and the ZAD, and saying like, you know, we shouldn't do resistance because resistance means this, this, and that. The Soulèvement de la Terre, the Earth uprisings, explicitly called people to build a network of resistance. They explicitly called people to participate. And, you know, members of the New Popular Front are members of the Soulèvement de la Terre, right? So I think it's a mistake to sort of make this sort of harsh opposition to all resistance in one sense, because if you don't do that, then how are you supposed to respond to all of the insanity you talk about in your article? Like the concentration camps, the mass, like that has to be resisted. If I didn't show up and fight, and I said this on your show last summer, if I don't go out and actually try to stop the far right from coming to power, like who am I to talk to anybody about racism or blah, blah, blah? It just doesn't make sense. It's not legible to anybody if they're like, oh, so you fight the far right. And well, no, I can't do that because then it's a popular front, capital P, capital F, and I can't do that. And so I'm, you know, just selling newspapers by the train. Like it doesn't speak to anybody. Whereas if you actually do the resistance and you do it correctly, not the resistance, the lib one, but a real resistance, then it's like inspiring to people. You can build the mass movement, right?
Right. So the critique I was trying to channel from Ross, and I don't have her book right in front of me, so I might not be phrasing this totally correctly. She saw in the ZAD, which was this land reclamation struggle that was able to prevent an airport from being built and, you know, through taking that territory sort of became something like an autonomous village in rural France, was that, you know, resistance would just be, we don't want the airport. We're going to stop the airport. But in the course of the struggle, it turned into, well, now we have something like a commune here, and we have a way of doing things at the commune. We have a way of organizing. We have a way of fighting. And that fighting isn't just about resistance anymore. It's not just about resisting the state approaching us, encroaching on us, but it's about survival here. So it turns from resisting the encroaching state or a party of the encroaching state in favor of maybe a different party or a different political movement towards something like communism, so towards the commune form of politics, which is what she's describing. And so
yeah, I would just say that, you know, if you look at the ZAD, they had this moment of resistance. They called people to come resist. People mm-hmm. came. They built these experiments. And then at the end of the thing, once, you know, everybody won, a lot of the experiments shut down and people left. Some of the experiments got reintegrated into the sort of fabric of society on favorable terms. But like, there's a dialectic there. You know, you're not going to have like infinitely, there's no mail coming to the ZAD.
Right.
Once the struggle was over, in the sense that the initial spark of it, this resistance to the airport construction, once the state surrendered, well, the farmers, you know, they would like to get their mail.
But my point in this, though, is that it's aspirational. The way I put it is,
yeah,
the pure meaning of resistance is a defeated paradigm that we have to move past by reconceiving all our political activity as building a base of power in our actual lives, our homes, workplaces, neighborhoods, worth defending as we would our lives.
Oh, I fully agree with that. And I fully agree with your critique of the lib, capital R, resistance, right?
On the other hand, defense and resistance are virtually synonymous. So I don't think I've made that point totally clear. And then previously in the article, I do mention that there will be resistance, and I go over these different places where there will be resistance to Trump. But I think the qualitative difference in sort of my prediction of what that's going to look like is we had, first of all, in 2016, people forget this, and I even heard, I was listening to our old friend Sam Cedar the other day talking about how there weren't riots when Trump won in 2016. There were. There were riots all over the country the night of maybe the election, or at least the day after.
J20 defendants was a huge topic.
J20 was, you know, on inauguration day, but even the day after the election in 2016, there were riots. I think in Philadelphia, Portland, probably other places too. Very proletarian riots as well. And I think anarchists and proletarians, something that looked more like the George Floyd uprising. And then on J20, you had a very like movement of movements coalition, including anarchists in the streets of DC. We all remember that Trump was, you know, very upset about the low turnout for his inauguration. A big part of that is because
the
there were these
of the photos and everything,
right? That was like the first scandal of his administration, right? That was because there was activist groups blockading the security entrances, so you know, thousands and thousands of Trump supporters could not get in. I don't doubt there will be some protests this time on J20, but they're going to be a lot smaller. I think that there probably won't be, maybe there'll be a black bloc, but it won't be hundreds of people, thousands of people like it was last time. So I think what we're looking at is a different resistance that's in a way more mature, but also more dire, because it's going to come from the people who are directly affected. It will not be an amorphous outpouring of rage in the streets, like after he was elected, nor will it be like these activist coalitions. But it's going to be, for example, people who are facing the first round of raids, undocumented people, resisting in their own way. We don't know what that'll look like yet. Trans and queer people are beginning to form networks to think about what resistance looks like. People who
talked last year to Pavlos Rufos about the EU deportation situation.
Mm-hmm.
And something that he said that's always stuck with me is that the most effective resistance were all of the sort of the legal teams working to basically just force the EU to actually implement all of its policies rigorously. And then that prevented, or that impeded significantly, the like pro deportation, the more harsher policies. But you're going to need folks like all throughout the system, right? You're going to need people doing the legal stuff. And that's what I think is missing in like the Anglo world broadly. If you want my critique, right? My critique is that without a radical left that has some kind of orientation to official politics, there's nothing that can kind of serve as the point where all of these struggles can be synthesized and that people can like easily find access to them, right?
Okay, so that's interesting because what you're describing about sort of the bureaucratic like red taping around deportations is basically something that I was critiquing. I wasn't critiquing it because I think that like the NGOs who are working tirelessly to defend like individuals from deportation are just part of the state and they're just a different kind of cop or something like that. I don't believe that. I respect these people. I think you've got a pretty good point there that more of the people I was associating with were, you know, people doing abolish ICE and ICE blockades, like blockades of ICE facilities. And when the NGO people told us, pick up your shit and go because you're actually making it harder for us to do our work, we didn't have an answer to that. And there wasn't really that kind of relationship of coordination.
Was there ever like a real proposal to abolish ICE, like legally?
Well, some politicians
ran on it. There was
never
like a law that was drafted that was like in Congress, wasn't there? I mean, I don't know.
There probably was. Someone from the squad probably put something like that together and it went nowhere. But yeah, Democrats were running on abolish ICE. I think even Harris said something about it at some points. Obviously, that's totally gone now.
Because you have to build basically like my sort of critique of the American left, the Anglo left. I share the critique of Varn that he brought up on his show recently, where Gen X left and anarcho-localism that is associated with it came to its sort of fruition in Occupy. But following Occupy, the sort of new millennial left understood that sitting in the park forever is not a real viable strategy, that we have to have some other, you know, orientation towards the political. The problem is that that orientation took the form of, well, if we push for executive power ASAP, we might be able to get some wins and sort of like kickstart the engine, and we'll try to use the Democratic Party, and we'll, you know, refer to the sort of dregs of the new left to help us do that. And they weren't really reflecting on the whole history of why all these things failed that you mentioned a minute ago with the social democracy critique and blah, 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 right? So when I talk about a radical left, what I'm saying is that we either need the DSA or an institution, a new institution that takes its place to break with the Democratic Party and propose radical changes to like the American Constitution and to American political life, with the understanding that you might not actually win for several election cycles, right? And if you think about the timeline, the Unbowed and Bernie kicked off at about the same time, but they had a very different strategy. And I think that's the problem. Corbyn and Sanders trying to work with Labor and the Democrats is a mistake. So like that would be my big critique for Americans, just to say, like, if you go back to anarcho-localist anti-politics, you're going to come to the same problems that we saw in the 2000s and in Occupy. If you keep doing millennial left social democracy, you're just going to get, you know, raked over the coals one time. I mean, look at this thing with the trans bathroom Congress situation. I forget her name. Is Sarah McBride? Did you see this?
Yep.
Where she's basically saying, like, you know, the Republicans, when they talk about trans, it's just a distraction, right? Let's not talk about whether or not I have the right to use the bathroom, blah, blah, blah. And for me, this strategy makes no sense, right? You have the superficial representation of a trans congressperson, right? A congresswoman. But they're not really fighting for it, the substantive politics that should go with it. Whereas in France, you have a guy who looks like a Poindexter, Antoine Léaumont, who's saying, like, we need to install in the Constitution the ability to freely and, like, free as in beer and free as in whenever you want, change your, you know, official legal status, right?
Well, I think there's a big structural difference between the Europe and the United States, also between the UK and Europe, which is that there is something like a, first of all, there's a much narrower field of political options. We haven't had the collapse of the major parties that Europe's had, and we probably won't. You know, Sanders is like musing now about a workers' party. And, you know, I'd love to see him try, but I do not think it will go anywhere. I think what is much more likely is the trajectory continuing that we're already on, which is that the right has successfully formed the institutions to take total state power, and render what remains of the Democrats as a permanent and loyal opposition. So the only political terrain left, in terms of not only the Democratic Party, but also the bureaucracy, is how loyal will they be? Will they continue to fight? Will they try to continue to slow, the building of concentration camps, in one way or another? And so that's what's left of like the potential of there being a more leftward oriented resistance that could have existed. You know, there's an alternate history where we could look at the resistance to Trump being more assertive or more coordinated in some way, and it resulting in Bernie Sanders being the president in 2020. That is entirely possible. It wasn't so far off from even happening. Now, I don't think this is possible for various reasons. The Supreme Court is one of them, and the judiciary in general, being so full of Trumpists, and not only full of Trumpists, but Trumpists who are very good at manipulating the way the court works, the way the Constitution is read and understood, the way that elections work. You know, we're in a pretty dire situation in terms of anything being possible electorally. That's the tone I was coming at in my article.
Of course.
Not a ideological. Which is why I published it. It wasn't an ideological, like, denunciation of voting or running as a Democrat or using the Democratic Party platform, because all that stuff makes sense to me. But it's making less and less sense as over the course of 8 years, it makes a lot less sense. You see what I'm saying?
No, of course. And I think if you look at, for example, the Green Party, right, there are districts in which the Green Party like came in second place in front of the Democrats, like in Dearborn and stuff. And the Green Party, as far as I understand, at least, isn't even a real party.
Right. Yeah, the Green Party
isn't actually trying to mobilize to take power or something.
Well,
like that,
their strategy is like, if we can keep, you know, increasing our vote percentage, it'll become a real party. But again, like, look at what the Green Party looks like in Germany and the UK. You know, this is not something we want to emulate.
Well, by the way, those parties strongly criticized the U.S. Green Party.
Oh, that's good.
They condemned the U.S. Green Party and said that you should just like cede to the Democrats. And Mélenchon said that if he lived in a blue state, he would vote for the Greens. So there is a tacit Green Party support. Right?
Interesting. Did Mélenchon say he would vote for the Democrats in a swing state?
I think what did he say exactly? I think he said, you know, I'm not telling Americans what to do. It's everybody's own individual choice. It's not my country. But as far as I can understand, you know, Trump is really bad. So if I was in a swing state, I would probably, you know, vote for Harris. And if I wasn't in a swing state, I would vote for the Greens.
There
he
you
said
go.
Something like that.
I agree with that. Right. So I just want to make one other point on what we've been talking about, which is this concept of anarcho-localism. That certainly exists. I know those people. I don't think it's correct to frame, for example, Occupy that way entirely. Occupy wasn't about like setting up dual power institutions in the park. It was about, you know, it was about many things. But I think, you know, the reason I was attracted to it, remain attracted to politics like that, is because it's trying to find a way around electoral politics towards mass politics. And this is the same thing that we're looking at with the ILC, with what Sean and other people are setting up, is trying to create civil social organizations, not because we think that civil social organizations will, you know, create dual power, build Soviets or whatever, but because there has to be another route towards mass politics than running as Democrats, even the DSA, which, you know, has had a lot of different ideas about how to get to mass politics other than elections, but is mostly oriented towards elections. That's where most of their success has come from. And we don't have that answer. You know, this is not a strategy that has borne results except for moments that are so spontaneous, it's hard to even say that anything leftists did lead to it, like the George Floyd uprising, even like Occupy to an extent. Occupy may have happened if it was just the kind of wingnuts running it. You know, a lot of communists were involved in organizing Occupy, but it was also, it just seemed like this moment that had to happen in the United States.
Well, let me unpack a little bit what I meant, because I think we might be talking past each other. The ILC, like, I'm very supportive. And I think, you know, as a syndicalist, I think it's good to do things like that. And I think we need civil social institutions, and I'm not opposed to building dual power or anything like that. When I was talking about anarcho-localism, I was meaning basically this idea that, at least when I was first getting involved in politics around Occupy, that there's no hope whatsoever of like a truly mass political like horizon. And so all we can do is try to like live as best we can, expecting the collapse.
Right. And that is a tendency that exists, but I do not think it is a very large one. I think everybody wants anyone who, you know, revolutionary or even I think radical liberals understand that there is an untapped political creativity that can radically change the kind of the logic of politics in the United States.
Well, and it has. My critique is unfounded, and I withdraw it. I apologize to the anarcho-localists. I besmirched you unfairly.
But we're just talking about discourse here, right?
Yeah, well, I would say also, like, if you think about, to go back to Kristen Ross and the Zad and things. In the Zad, you had this one specific local thing that could be seen as, like, anarcho-localist, right? And eventually it won. So these kind of experiments, to me, when I say that they hit their limit, that they can't win in like a bigger sense, I'm not saying they can never do anything, right? But the issue is that like the Zad hit a certain limit, as I was saying, dialectically, where like once the airport is no longer a project, well, then you can't have a zone to defend against the airport, right? Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? And what people did is they made this Earth Uprisings, or in French, the Soulèvement de la Terre movement, that took a different form and spread ecological struggles throughout the country in a more accessible way. And that's basically what I'm arguing for. So if my critique up until now has tripped over some of the details and I've been, I haven't been convincing you, what I'm basically arguing for is we have to generalize radical politics such that more people can get involved and there can be connections between the ILC, between the eco struggles, between the people doing deportations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think if you, a better example, a more recent example would be Stop Cop City in Atlanta. Certainly very anarchistic, certainly very local, but yeah. if you read the writings from it, it's always had a horizon of generalizing. The way it talked about generalizing was like, well, they're going to build cop cities everywhere. This is part of the security state strategy in this decade, is to build a ton more cop cities to keep police happy, to bring some dignity back to the job, some prestige back to the job, to make them more efficient and more brutal in various ways. And so our the next stage as abolitionists, as revolutionaries, is to build power by fighting these cop cities. It was incredibly successful in Atlanta. I think, initiatives kicked off all over the country to do these things. They're underway in New York. I think it's
the pro-Palestine movement is a good counterexample, right? I'm sure a lot of the energy of people that were involved in Stop Cop City ended up, spreading through the pro-Palestine movement. Mm-hmm. But when I look at it, it's just a lot easier to get involved in. It's like, I'm a student at a university. Well, I need to learn, what is my university doing with Palestine? Do we invest in Israeli like arms technology? Do we, what's going on here? And then people, set up an encampment and it spreads everywhere. And that's a moment where people get into politics. So, I'm not at all opposed to occupying, blockading these kind of activities. I think, they're really good and it's important for people to do that. But the issue is, okay, you do the encampment and the encampment gets expelled, then what do? Right? If you have a diffuse, like federated structure of the radical left, well, people, like, you can be in the union and in the pro-Palestine movement and in this ILC type, like you can be in all these things at once. And there's a sort of a fabric or a nervous system that can
connect.
Are
you sort
them
of
all.
Getting at the document you shared with me about how Unbowed works?
About the structured. Unbowed structure, because basically what the Unbowed are, right, is a series of like neighborhood assemblies all over the country. I mean, there's more than 100,000 people that are involved in this, and there's like been 20,000 people that joined in this year alone.
Is this document
5,000?
Could I share this document in the show notes?
Yeah. Well, let me just, after the show, let me read over it to make sure I don't put anything personally identifying, but yeah.
All right. So maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't, but maybe you could, because you make a strong argument for why it's successful, why the structure has led to the spreading of these assemblies and how it reproduces them. So is that something you'd be able to go over now?
Yeah, I can do it very quickly. So basically, the fundamental unit of the Unbowed movement, and it's a movement. It is a movement form, not a party form. So there's not like a local head and a departmental head and a regional head and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have the form of a traditional political party. It has the form of a social movement. The fundamental unit of the social movement is called the Action Group. And all this developed out of sort of Bernie-style campaign stuff with Mélenchon. Right. So like, what are the basic things that people do in the Action Group? Well, they go out and they flyer, They put up posters, right? They go to marches. They go to protests. They do solidarity with people, right? They throw dinners. They throw, you know, debates. They throw a book club. You see what I mean? A lot of the events of the action group can be very low intensity. And I think that's very important and good, because basically you can invite somebody like, hey, you oppose the system. Let's go flyer. And, you know, they're like confronting their neighbors, you know, with this propaganda in real life, talking to people, you know, like actually doing politics as a baby step. It's really important to take people from like posting to actual politics, right? So that's a critical step. The second critical thing about the action group is it's basically a consensus-based neighborhood assembly whose goal is to promote the program of the Unbowed. And we can talk about the program later, but basically the program is organically developing over time. It's public, everybody can read it. And it's a radical left program that looks to have a rupture with social democracy, capitalism, blah, 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 right? So, okay. You have these assemblies. How many are there? Well, if you look at the DSA for comparison, right? DSA would be at like the scale of a city. Like Louisville has a DSA, I think, right? Or like New York has how many chapters? Mm-hmm. I don't know. How many chapters do they have for New York?
Maybe four, five.
Like four, right? If it was the Unbowed, there would be like 15 or 20 in New York. Mm-hmm. Because the idea would be like you could even have one of these action groups in a building. They should be between like 10 and 15 people max.
One for each arrondissement?
Yeah, you could do one per arrondissement. Yeah.
There you go.
You could do that. Or, but it could be even more specific. Like if you live in a big project tower, there are literally some action groups in a project tower. Or like if you work at a big factory, you can have an action group in your factory. Or if you, I don't know, you're at the university, there can be action groups in the university or in the high school, right? Because it can basically be organized however you need it to be, because it's, you know, there's a website, you go to the website, there's an app, you say, I want to create an action group, you create it, it's on the map, people find you, you find them. You can like get certified by the national level, which basically means you can get propaganda sent to you for cheap or free, right? Mm-hmm. But it's very open and easy for people to get into. And then because it's like each of these action groups is a little horizontal structure, it's very easy for people to like demonstrate competence or gain skills and then move up their political activity, right?
Yeah, I was impressed by this concept of like it sort of trains you in leadership skills.
Yeah, because it's like a little like an Occupy. I mean, I don't know. When you were in like Zuccotti, what was the biggest meeting you were in?
I wasn't actually in Zuccotti, unfortunately. I missed it.
Okay. Well, there was like, I mean, I remember there was some meeting. I mean, if you ever try to do a meeting with like more than 15 people, it's very difficult, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're just saying like, I'm here with like six of my friends or 10 of my friends, and you know, I should mention that typically there's two facilitators for each of these action groups. There's usually one man and one woman. And then the Unbowed also has higher level structures. So you have like at the regional level, you can have like a group that coordinates across all of these action groups. But again, the way it works is whatever you want to do. So if the regional promote, you know, proposes you to do something and you don't want to do it, then you don't do it. There's no like expect, you're not a member, you're not paying dues, you're not expected to do anything other than respect, you know, like you can't hit somebody or, you know, if there's like an ethical thing, there's like an ethics committee that you can report people to, right? But beyond that sort of level and the program, you're not obliged to participate in any particular event if you don't want to. It's consensus based most of the time.
Would you, so you talked about like film screenings and reading groups, for example. Are these things that are suggested by the party, or they have to be approved by the higher levels? Or can you, or
no,
can you just read or show?
There's no approval. And I mean, there's stuff that's suggested, and there is a level of national coordination. So as you go up to the national level, there are like national assemblies that happen, you know, every so often, where people are taken by sortition from all of the action groups, and they go and they like sort of discuss the program, and then the program is, you know, revised, and the program is, you know, mm-hmm. coming back down to all. So there is like a vertical aspect, but I think it's about as horizontal as you can be without doing like tyranny of structurelessness.
Okay. And
it's not an internal democracy. There's not like voting for who's in leadership.
You call it a duocracy.
I would say it's like organic centralism.
And I think we talked about this a little bit on one of the previous episodes, but one thing that's really fascinating about it is you say the organization's based on a historical materialist analysis of the 21st century social conditions. What is it exactly about our conditions that makes this kind of structure make sense today, as opposed to like democratic centralism, for example?
So there's a book, a recent book by Melanchon that talks about this. It's called Do Better, but I think it's going to be translated in English with a different title.
Yeah, Do Better does not sound good in English.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good in English. But he's written several books over the years, and I think this is going to be the first. I think it's supposed to come out with Verso in the spring or the late winter of 2025. So be on the lookout for that for a more detailed exposition. But essentially,
can you get him on the show?
He doesn't speak English.
Oh, okay.
As far as I know.
You can translate?
I think Dan Denver said he might have an interview with him.
Oh, okay.
So you might be too small fry, Andy.
Yeah, maybe.
You just get me. But what I was saying is like, so what is this material analysis? So if you think about what's our social life like, right? Well, we have this network dependency, not just network addiction or network connection, but like an actual dependency. How many days can like New York go without having a food shipment, right? Where's the water for the city coming from? What's the electric situation? What's the communication grid? These grids define our actual daily life. And they don't just define them in the sense that they structure our thought and everything like this, but we're wholly dependent on them for social reproduction and survival. So given this, and given this, the fact that now capitalism is a world system, which it was not in Marx's day, right? And given the conditions of capitalism now apply to, unless you're living in a very, you know, remote corner of the world, most people on Earth are urbanized and have been now for like a decade, right? And there's mass migrations of people, given the climate crisis, pushing them into new urban environments, which all of these cause stresses on the existing social order, which is why, you know, things like migration are such a hot topic. They're not just a hot topic because racists are using them for their own sick ends, but it's also because a lot of people are migrating. Like, I migrated. A lot of people have migrated. A lot of people have moved all over the world, right? And this is not something that happened 200 years ago on the same scale. So given that, we have the situation where you show up in like a new city for work or whatever, and you're an atomized subject with no like family or land or whatever ties per se. And you find yourself living based on these networks that you don't actually have any control over. You're just subjected to these networks as a member of like the population. So you're like a statistic, right? Like a cow on a farm. And the proposal of the Unbowed is that we need to take sovereignty over these networks. Mm-hmm. And by taking sovereignty over these networks, we go from being the population to being the people, asserting our sovereignty, asserting our political power, and asserting our collective like will to own and control these means of production and social reproduction, all these things. So the historical like Marxist critique of capitalism and everything is included. The goals of the workers' movement are included. The stuff about, you know, like the feminist critique, the ecological critique, the stuff about the Anthropocene I mentioned earlier, all this stuff is included and flowing into this theory. It's not like we don't think about whatever was said in the past. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is there's a sort of new synthesis of this given the conditions we find ourselves in. And for me, it's pretty persuasive because it actually presents a coherent theory of the problem and the solution, mm-hmm. right? Which I can talk, like I just explained to you it relatively quickly.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I can talk to people about this and it makes sense to them.
Right. It certainly does. I just, you know, I'm wondering like in the US context, because it is like a answer to the question I just asked, which is that, okay, we know how to build small local groups that are civil social or activist or, you know, mutual aid or Ice Watch, something like that. But there's no concept about how to link to mass politics without going through either the Democratic Party electorally or through their NGO networks. Because when you get to a certain level of professionalism, that's all just captured by the Democratic Party, more or less, or dependent on the Democratic Party, at least. And conversely, it can be crushed. And the article about Italy and New International Mag looks at how Maloney is sort of crushing these networks as well.
Yeah.
So it does provide an interesting case of how to build autonomous networks that are coordinated. And would you say that these are coordinated sort of like is the energy of coordination towards winning elections to defeat the far right? Or is that just a sort of incidental result?
It's not possible within the current order to do what we need to do. That's the fundamental thing. So we have to change the political order. Mm-hmm. We have to have a constitutional change. We have to have a radical change. A political, politics with a capital P has to be done. So how are we going to do it? Well, as Mélenchon would probably say, if I can translate one of his speeches, like, you know, go ahead, you know, try to just like fight off all of the drones and everything yourself by hand if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. You got to get that, right. That cool trident looking air gun thing.
Like, that's not real, right? That's not a real solution. And so I think that kind of response is just that, that would be like, I was actually talking to somebody in the Unbowed about this the other day, because we were talking about Blanqui. And I was defending Blanqui in his context, like the 1830s, because he's living in a, you know, reactionary monarchic system. There is no like way to do mass politics and like try to unite people in the unions and electoral. It didn't exist in his time. The only thing they could do is have a secret society and try to overthrow the state by arms. That was the only thing he could do. Mm-hmm.
And Lenin and the Bolsheviks as well.
Well, I mean, we can, there's, you know, every historical time has its conditions, and like democratic centralism emerges in the crisis of the Russian Social Democratic Party being repressed, right? Are we in that situation or not? So should we adopt that form or not? And I think it's a mistake to say like, well, that's what revolution looks like. And so that's what we have to do.
Right.
We should think about our own conditions. So the idea in France is that the current constitution makes it basically impossible. Like the situation with Europe makes it impossible to do what we need to do. So we have to take power. Given the electoral system in place, we do believe it's actually possible to do, to actually win. Once we win, we have a constituent assembly, we make a new constitution, we renegotiate our relationship with Europe, we renegotiate our relationship with NATO, right? And the next time, like in the Tunisian uprising, when, you know, leaders from Tunisia came to France and asked for help, like, hey, we can't pay anybody, we don't know what to do, blah, 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 blah. They're going to get a different response from us than they got from Hollande, mm-hmm. right? Having an actual international partner there that is ready to like help the English or help the Americans or help the Libyans or whoever needs help to make their equivalent revolution, that is something that we would be in a position to do. And there would need to be an international sort of succession of these things. Without that, we would just end up in a, you know, we'd end up blocked by the international situation.
Okay.
Which is why I call for a new international movement. You'd have to have people all over the world doing this.
Right. So I'd like to jump to the fun half, go behind the paywall right now, and talk a little bit more about some of the other content on New International. Maybe talk a little bit more about your ideas of maybe how we can integrate what you're proposing, what's worked for you in France with Unbowed, as we sort of reconfigure our politics in the second Trump era. And maybe if we have some time, we'll talk about Christianity as well, because on your podcast forums, you talk a lot about Christianity. And even for a Jew like me, I find it very compelling. So subscribe at patreon.com/theAntifada if you want to hear the second half of the discussion. Also, follow us on Blue Sky at theantifada.bluesky.social or whatever. I just signed up for that today.
Migration.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it looks cool over there. So I've just been on it today for the first time, but it looks like it's a little bit more active than Twitter, which seems to be really falling apart. Even if
the
you block.
The key thing about Blue Sky is that they don't suppress the links.
Uh-huh.
So like for New International on the stats, even though there's less people interacting with us on Blue Sky, our growth is actually better because Twitter actively suppresses links.
And what article, by the way, is doing the best?
I think your article is doing the best.
That's right. I knew it.
It wasn't the first couple days, but it's picked up.
It's going viral. The people love the...
The Citizen Marx had a big moment at the beginning. People were loving it.
Well, that's Marx is old news. All right, let's take a little
Marx
break.
Is old. We don't need to talk about that.
Go behind the paywall.